All right, let's welcome in Matt Packness, who was a former Penn State graduate assistant in the years of 1987, 1988, a former Ivy League football player himself, and also a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. And Matt, this is a very sensitive subject, discussing Penn State and how they chose to honor Joe Paterno last weekend. And I really appreciate you joining us right now on SB Nation Radio and lending us your perspective.
Thanks, Lewis.
Now, Matt, for those who, I guess, may not have been paying attention last weekend, Penn State elected to, in their game against Temple, honor Joe Paterno, the 50th anniversary of his very first game coached as head coach at Penn State. And I read on your blog last night, in a very interesting post, mattpackness.blogspot.com, that you did not feel that Joe Paterno should have been honored at this point in time. And if you don't mind, could you share with us why?
Yeah, I think, you know, being a survivor, but also appreciating the pain and the damage that those victims went through, especially those 10 boys that were brave enough to get up and take a stand and testify against Jerry Sandusky. You know, I think it just was really blind and deaf of the whole group to carry out this celebration in regards and sort of disregarding their feelings and their needs and, you know, what they need in order to heal. And it also sort of sends a message overall that these temporal wins on a football field have more precedence than the well-being of a psyche or soul of a young man. And I think that's the most dangerous thing. If there had never been, or if there had been an immediate response from the Paterno family saying, hey, this is what we can do to make people aware, to learn more, to how to protect kids and that kind of thing, I think that might have gone, you know, a little bit further in acknowledging, or if there even was some time set up during this honor of coach to teach people about this horrific power and control dynamic that fosters abuse. You know, that might have been okay, but just to celebrate is not okay. It's really denial. It's cognitive dissonance.
And Matt, you wrote this on your blog, and I thought this was very interesting, that the image that Joe Paterno projected, we can call it his brand, the academic look, the tweed jackets, the Oxford shirts, the ties, the khakis, all of that sort of projected this image to the public that here's a guy that cares a lot about not only winning, but winning the right way. And you also coached alongside him as a graduate assistant those 2 years I mentioned, 1987 and 1988. And you mentioned the fact that behind the scenes he was a bit of a bully. I mean, could you share with us this side of Joe Paterno that the public did not get to see?
Yeah, well, not only that, my locker was right next to his because our lockers were arranged alphabetically. So we'd sit there and, you know, I was the lowest of low man on the totem pole. I think we had four other GAs at the time. Each team could have five. And the other four were coming back for a second year, and I was a brand new guy. So, but yeah, he, you know, one thing in particular regarding academic requirements, you know, the academic advisor there at the time would come and complain, you know, on the sidebar. And most of the staff would on the sidebar come and complain about Joe and what he was doing, the decisions he was making, and how they, Jerry in particular, Sandusky, just, you know, would pull me and say, I hate that guy. But, mm-hmm. And I never really wanted to get into those, but the one with the academic advisor really made me raise my eyebrows because he said that Joe, you know, made him again switch someone's schedule to assure that this player was going to be on the field every day during the week. At the detriment to the player's education. And it was just, that's counter opposite to what Joe ever professed. Now, I know Joe's not here to defend himself, mm-hmm. and I don't want to slam him, but it's just as a warning, there's so many people out there that we, particularly in this day and age, that we sort of celebrate, that we put up on a pedestal. And the way we vet these people is often questionable. You know, Joe went there on Rip Engel's tailcoat and then was sort of protected by Rip for many years and sort of evolved, but no one really checked to make sure that he was balancing competency with values and leadership. And I think that's a challenge we have now. You know, the results aren't the full package. There are a lot of young boys in the wake. I mean, we know the ones that are still alive, but we know also suicide's a very high incident rate for survivors of childhood sexual abuse. And so, I mean, it's terrific to see what happened, you know, in light of this, his projecting this image.
Matt Packness joins us right now, a former Penn State graduate assistant, 1987-1988, also a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. He's joining us right now on SB Nation Radio. Matt, you also touched on the fact that when you were around defensive coordinator Jerry Sandusky, that you saw a couple warning signs and you even had a conversation with him about being uncomfortable with the way he interacted with children, but you also did not view anything that crossed over into becoming abuse. So what?
Yeah, I never saw anything sexual. Absolutely not. I would like to think, you know, I was 24, 25 at the time. So, but I would like to think, and you know, that you're up there. You're like, it's like the Catholic Church. You know, Joe's the Pope,
oh, sure,
and Jerry's a cardinal. And so, but you know, I would like to think that I'd take that stand, and I did. We were one of the first schools to have those camps. And, again, this was somewhat deceptive because you couldn't have more than X amount of visits for your recruits. But if you had a camp and you invited everybody, you could have your superior recruits out to your camp as well, as long as all these other students came. So we had kids from, like, 7th grade up to going into their senior year in high school attend these camps. And he was like the Pied Piper, you know. He'd be grabbing, headlocking, pinching. I was always taught, and I was always very aware that, you know, you don't put your hands on anybody, particularly a younger person, unless you're teaching a technique. And there are a bunch of other people looking around. So I asked him, you know, once, if, you know, what, coach, you know, privately, why are you doing that? And he goes, he laughed and he said, I just love kids. And, you know, I was like, well, you know, I can't really argue with that, but it just doesn't make me feel right. I wish at the time I had more awareness of myself and of the situation. You know, sort of like, it wasn't beyond my comprehension, clearly, but it was beyond my expectation. There was just no way I would expect that in that environment. And he was positioned. I came from a high school team that never lost a game over 3 years, and I was a sole 3-year starter, and we ended up top of New Jersey. We were like Hoosiers for football. And my coach, you know, that's why I got into coaching. He basically, Coach Ted Monica, he basically sort of saved my life, and the assistant coaches got me into a structured program. My grades flourished. Everything turned around in my life because of sports, in particular football. And so that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to do that with other kids, you know, to help them. And it's crazy because, you know, that was sort of like my salve. And these guys, Sandusky and Paterno, were using it to destroy kids. And maybe not Paterno intentionally, but clearly he didn't do anything, and that's sometimes even worse. His indifference is even worse. That's the opposite of love, you know. That's indifference. That's abuse.
And Matt, I want to continue this conversation. Use the term cognitive dissonance on your blog to describe the way that people view Joe Paterno's success on the field and perhaps look beyond what he did or did not do vis-a-vis Jerry Sandusky. And you felt, and you were telling us at the end of last segment, that you feel that he personally, he knew something at least and did not act. So how do you view his situation in Jerry Sandusky's sort of awful crimes that he committed?
Well, you know, I guess there'll be a bigger, much bigger person than me to sort of decide and determine that.
Sure.
in the long run. But, you know, I think Joe was known, even when he was there as an assistant, he was known as Joe the Rat because he knew everything, and he would report it to Rip Engel. And then even as the head coach, I mean, he knew everything. He's a very bright man. So for me to think, and me to know, and now I think court documents state that going back to 76, players approached to Joe to say that Jerry had, you know, inappropriately touched them, and Joe just sort of buried it. Now, that can be his own cognitive dissonance, meaning that those behaviors just, he struggled. He couldn't figure out how those behaviors sort of fit into the image he was trying to project and what he was trying to build there at Penn State, or if it's more devious, he intentionally, knowingly let Jerry carry it on because he knew Jerry was a very successful and bright defensive mind, and he didn't want these much lesser, in his mind, not in my mind, but what he would perceive maybe lesser important people to get in the way of that success or that drive.
So he was all aware, kind of almost borderline omniscient when it came to things that happened within his program, and you personally find it difficult to believe.
Total control.
That he would not have known.
Total power.
Now, what do you make of the notion that this was a different time in the 1970s and the 1980s, and we're not as aware as we are of childhood sexual abuse today in 2016, and that maybe he heard it and he thought these tales are too fantastical, that this can't be what everyone thinks. It has to be some kind of misunderstanding.
Well, you know, I think, and this gets back to the long debate, you know, if he was really a great man, would it have ever started? Or the minute it started, he would have ended it. And, why isn't this coming up about the great coaches like Bob Devaney or, the other coaches that were out there in other schools? God forbid that it did happen. But my assumption is that there was a special dynamic, a power dynamic there that, if it's power and control is about fear and criticism. And I think more than wanting to be a mature, rational, objective adult and just look at things evenly, Joe really motivated a lot of players by fear, and it was the fear not only of not failing, but fear of being ostracized. There was a thing called the Joe's Doghouse, and that was the last thing you wanted to do, was get put in that Joe's Doghouse, because that could ruin your career. And so he, I think because of that, when you have that kind of dynamic in any organization, it'll foster other sections or factions of fear and power and control, and that's what sexual abuse is. Sexual abuse is not sex. I mean, sex is an act between two consenting adults of the comparable peer groups. What Jerry did was attack and assault these kids, and it's criminal behavior. And my guess is that anyone who saw this in other programs around the country, if it ever came up, they knew enough, regardless of what era it was in, to stop it. And this is unhealthy behavior. This is not normal, rational behavior. This is really sick behavior. And for whatever reason, it was allowed to go on. And what's so disturbing is that just the opposite image was projected. And again, I have a feeling if the players ever knew, they would have turned state's evidence. My great fear is that I think a majority of the coaches probably did know.
Now, when it comes to Matt Packness joins us right now, former Penn State graduate assistant on SB Nation Radio. When it comes to viewing the Paterno era at Penn State that did have a number of successes, national championships, historic wins, academic successes, and you deal with this awful, horrific tragedy that he on some level is responsible for, how do you think the university should deal with his tenure as head coach and those successes achieved?
Yeah, that's a tough one because I went there and I wanted to work for a man that I thought was and not only that, we played against him when I was an undergraduate at Brown. Ironically, all touchdowns we had about 400 yards on him, and all three touchdowns were scored behind me. We lost 38-21. I think they let it up on us, but we played down there, and everyone's in it, my image including. Plus, Joe's a Brown grad, so we had this. Just a great sense of admiration. And I got there, and I could tell that it wasn't what it was projected to be. And so, in order to celebrate, I think wins are again, that's important. They're temporal. What's the real essence of a man is to, I think, solve problems. And one of the essence of a great leader in a great organization, does it create new leaders? And does it create people that are going to make society bring up the level of thought and conduct and also improve society? And that's the one unique thing about Joe's program, is that he did not create a lot of new head coaches. There was another coach that I was considering working for named Don James out at the University of Washington. He was a he was a cultivator of great coaches. Probably greatest protege is Nick Saban down at Alabama. But Coach Paterno did not do that because the program was about Joe. Now, does that undermine the success that the players had and their fellow classmates had and their cherished moments? I think that can be compartmentalized, but I don't think you can just say Joe's a great man or a great coach. You have to integrate and say that, just like when a child realizes that one of his parents or both his parents are no good, it's very difficult. Some people are never able to come to that rationalization, but to realize that, you know, hey, this person did these things that were pretty good, but they did these things that were really bad, and I just have to remember them for that and realize that, you know, they did some bad stuff.
All right, Matt, we really appreciate you joining us, and I do want to give you some space here. If anybody out there listening right now has a thought or a suspicion that a child might be in danger of childhood sexual abuse, what should they do?
Yeah, you know, the obvious signs is quick drop. What happened to me, quick drop in school performance. I was like 9 or 10 years old. Withdrawal, anxiety. I was picking my hair. These are all things. There was crisis in my family. My mom was terminally ill. So, you know, I was like a second thought. And so, you know, just the natural protection that would have gone on, and that's often what happens with predators. They target kids from families like that. Just the telltale signs that a child is disruptive, that this is some changes. There's body marks, you know, bruises that are unexplained. More talking about sexual conduct and sexual activity that's inappropriate for the age group. From a predator perspective, guys that just hang around, or people that just hang around that shouldn't be hanging around, spending more time with people, trying to befriend people. These are con artists. They're salesmen. Go to the local authorities. That's one of the best things. Go to the local authorities. On a national scope, there are organizations. There's one I'm involved with. It's called Male Survivor. You can go on their board, malesurvivor.org. It's the most widely visited website internationally for this kind of service. But, you know, I think looking up anything, you know, how do you respond to childhood sexual abuse, plug that into your search engine, and there will be a lot of local services that come up. But the best thing you can do is call your local police. There is no, if you report any sort of suspected child abuse, there is no retribution or whatsoever. It's every case is looked into with a great level of sincerity and detail. And the people that report it are never held accountable or held at any sort of problem or challenge if it doesn't turn out to be true.
And for anyone out there listening that perhaps dealt with similar issues as a child and has not sought help, what do you recommend?
Yeah, I think there's lists. What you want to do is get involved. You can go to your local mental health agency. You can go to your local hospital, your emergency room. If you have a doctor, you know, obviously want to talk to them. But what you really want to do is talk to a licensed specialist, a counselor who's licensed, who specializes in trauma, PTSD, or childhood sexual abuse. And those are the folks you got to. It's really a five-step process. Sharing your secrets, getting it out. Once you get those out, it's like the weight of the world's going to lift off your shoulders. Then you can identify how this has really screwed up your thoughts or interfered with the way to think healthy and to act healthy. And then you can start making better choices in the moment to make better outcomes, make better decisions, make better results, and ultimately then surround yourself with more healthy people and better organizations. And those are the steps, but, you know, it takes some time, takes some work. But once you find a good counselor, and there are plenty out there, just make sure that they're specialized and they're licensed. They can do wonders for you.
All right. Once again, guys, he is Matt Packness. If you want to read his work on Penn State, mattpackness.blogspot.com, a former Penn State assistant, also a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. Obviously a stakeholder here beyond the average sports talk show host and sports radio listener when it comes to Penn State and how the university should handle the Paterno legacy. And Matt, I really appreciate you lending your perspective and talking about an issue that can't be easy.
My pleasure, Lewis. Hopefully we help some folks.